Hey there.
I host a show called Therapy Gecko, where I dress up as a lizard and talk to anonymous strangers from the internet about their lives. They tell me their relationship problems.
I found out that I was related to the guy that I was dating.
Their hobbies.
I collect my roommate's toenails and fingernails.
Their secrets.
When we did not have toilet paper, I would use the shower curtain.
And also sometimes kind of serious stuff.
I have anxiety when I talk to people.
I'm also sometimes joined by celebrity guests like Doja Cat, Lil Yachty, Bobby Lee, and Eric Andre. Some of the more interesting calls we've gotten recently include a guy who argued with a demon living on his wall, a caller drunk at his job at a middle school, and a caller wondering whether or not he should transform into a dog. So if you're sick of your own life and you want to get lost in the life of a stranger, search for Therapy Gecko wherever you get your podcasts.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You guys can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. In this episode of the show, I'm joined by my buddy, Alex Gladstein from the Human Rights Foundation. I, of course, brought him on the show to talk about Bitcoin. It's Alex's biggest passion. It's one of my biggest passions. And I think that unfairly on this show, we maybe have given the Bitcoin community a little bit too much criticism for some of the recent toxicity. And Alex really did a good job getting us back on track for why Bitcoin is so important, both economically and sociologically. And basically no one else in the world I would rather listen to talk about politics and crypto than Alex. So I hope that you guys enjoy the show. If you want to support the show, you can leave a rating or review on iTunes, or you can subscribe on patreon.com/takecast. Now let's go ahead and get into the episode. All right, everyone, very excited to welcome back to the show Alex Gladstein from the Human Rights Foundation. He was on the show a couple months ago, I think a great episode, but it's been a big year for Bitcoin and for the crypto community. And Alex has, I think, some fascinating perspective on the Bitcoin community. Just the a priori before everything else, I feel let down by the Bitcoin community, Alex. I think that when I was first discovering Bitcoin, it was a very open community. It was a lot about ideas and education and bringing people in. And that is not, I do not think of the Bitcoin community as inclusive anymore.
Yeah, that's an interesting take, but I think a pretty common one these days. And I think it's a result of like basically social media discussions over the, maybe 4 or 5 months. There was much more. I mean, if you went back a year ago,
no one has this opinion. I would not have had this opinion a year ago.
Well, I think it rises and falls historically in the Bitcoin space with the cycles of the bull and the bear markets. There's like, Bitcoin tends to like, and you know, whatever, past performance is not a way for us to predict the future, but Bitcoin tends to sort of lead these rallies right out of the depths of these bear markets going back 10 years. And at the beginning of that rally, everybody's pretty happy, right? Like we're just kind of sticking it to the no coiners, like people today who are very anti sort of Bitcoin, like say maximalists, they're even saying have fun staying poor, right? Like last sort of December, January, like basically a year ago, it was a really unique time, really, really fun. But then the realities of the sort of the cycle start to hit for everybody. You start to see these crazy, insane bull market for altcoins, like you know, and when I, meaning like that, that the least coherent and rational coins are doing the best, like literally the meme coins, like Shiba Inu is like, if you're just talking about straight financial performance 12 months ago, you should have been investing in Shiba Inu today, right?
Right.
And it's
right.
like, what are the, you know, there's not like a lot of lessons you can draw from that, right? Like, you know, everybody, no, I, very few people.
I mean, maybe like grander sociological lessons, but nothing about like technical analysis or what kind of blockchains people like.
Yeah. And I think we could talk about the GameStop thing, which happened, you know, about
totally,
a year ago as well.
Totally inextricable from all of this, from NFTs, from I think you're totally right that those things are linked.
Yeah. So there's like, let's say there's, let's call it, there's two layers, and Bitcoin speaks to both of those layers, but Bitcoiners, let's say people who are hardcore about Bitcoin care more deeply about like a, let's say a deeper layer. Let's just call it layer one is like, let's stick it to the man. Let's stick it to the establishment. Let's stick it to the financial system. Let's stick it to the art world. Let's stick it to all of the people who control the way that money and kind of our communications work today. Web 2, let's stick it to Facebook.
Sure.
And that's like, that's your big tent, right? Everybody's on board pretty much, obviously, in the, you know, say crypto community with that general sentiment. I think the dispute that Bitcoiners have is they're concerned about some of these new systems, specifically like, let's say Web 3. I don't think Bitcoiners care that much about NFTs. I think some of them think that it's stupid, but it's not something that they get super riled up about. I think the Web3 thing has been the big, debate recently, you know, that crystallized by Jack Dorsey going after Andreessen Horowitz. And that's one that I, like, look, if you want to, you got like, the NFT thing, I think is here to stay. Yeah, and if folks can make NFTs inside,
But I actually, I just want this on the record on my podcast. Actually sort of hate the NFT community. I like NFTs. I own NFTs. I buy them. I sell them. But the NFT community is, I am far more annoyed by the NFT people than I ever am by Bitcoiners, by ETH maxis, because the idea that the key to, financial freedom and breaking away from the man is like cartoon pictures of JPEGs. Like I get that sociologically, digital ownership is huge and is going to become a much larger part of our society as we become more and more online. And I say this all the time, you know, we're already in the metaverse, but I know you see these tweets like, oh, there's only 9 million active wallets that have an NFT, bro. We're so early. And like, I think those are the wrong lessons to be learning. And I just really hate that stuff.
Well, again, just to recap, you know, a year ago, we had this uniting moment that we have every time these sort of like, let's say these crypto bull markets start, where pretty much everybody's like really jazzed and everybody's involved with Bitcoin at one level or another. So that's cool. And everybody was like, let's stick it to the man, like, you know, screw the financial system and, you know, let's invest in GameStop, you know, just to stick it to them. And, you know, again, that sort of sours over the following 12 months as these kind of new projects come out, as tension builds in the Ethereum community, as tension builds in the Bitcoin community. You have both of these coins, which are the dominant coins, get destroyed financially by meme coins.
Right.
People are coping on that, however they want to cope.
Sure, I mean, lots of copium to be had.
You know, like I haven't been in this space for too long. I came into it before the previous bull market, though. So I started to get really involved in the social media, at like following people actively, like let's say, at the beginning of the last bull market. So it was sort of similar where like at the end of early 2017, I started really paying attention. I started to like follow some people on, let's say, crypto Twitter, but at that point, Bitcoin Twitter. And I saw the sort of rise and fall of that bull market. And I do think that what ends up happening is that I'm sure some Bitcoin maximalist folks are coping fine, I think that's quite obvious. But I think
but there's coping on both sides, right? To be fair, yeah. there are also the Ethereum people that'll be like, oh, I never think about Bitcoin. What can you do with Bitcoin? What does a Bitcoin right. even do? Right. And no, that's cope too.
Sure. I guess what I mean by that is like, there were some in the 2017 cycle, there were some Bitcoiners who probably were pissed off that they missed out on all these ICOs. Yeah. But I think like there is a large percentage of Bitcoiners who are basically like, I don't really care how much money you can make in ICOs in Silicon Valley on Wall Street. That's not why I'm here. I'm here to create something new.
Right.
And that still exists today. It's just slightly framed differently in the same way that ICOs made ridiculous amounts of like way more than Bitcoin could ever make if you were minting these ICOs. 2017, 2018. It's similar today with, let's say, you got in early to like, whether it's meme coins or Solana or Avalanche or like high-end NFT stuff, like you can make way more money short-term in these systems. I think that Bitcoiners were skeptical then 4 or 5 years ago of ICOs and the premise and like what they were kind of from a, you know, philosophical, moral background and also probably just sustainability perspective. Similarly, like I think Bitcoiners are skeptical about Avalanche and Solana and this other stuff. And what's fascinating is now you have the Ethereum community start to exhibit like some of the same behavior.
Right. Like why would you build on Sol when you can build on ETH? And it's just the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny because like we in the Bitcoin community, we've been kind of like pointing out some of these like risks of centralization to the Ethereum people for years. Obviously that's been like the, I would say the two conflict areas between the Bitcoin community and the Ethereum community have been over the idea of the pre-sale and of minting money out of thin air and giving it to people. That was kind of like what Bitcoin was created to fight against. And then the other one, of course, is this idea of centralization. So there's like the pre-mine and the centralization aspects are what Bitcoiners, including myself, have been very critical of Ethereum for. And all of a sudden, now you have the Ethereum people, you know, like splintering into tribes and going after the other folks. And, you know, I was listening to some kind of sort of crypto investors talk on some different shows more recently. There's a good one called Uncommon Core with a couple of pretty sharp, let's say, crypto investors. And they're like still very into Ethereum, but they're talking to each other. They're like, hey, we feel like boomers because there are all these people who got into Avalanche at like $3. And they're like, why would I ever deal with Ethereum? This is ridiculous, right? So so I think what's happening is you have a whole group, a massive percentage of people in crypto today haven't ever experienced a bear market. I don't know exactly what the numbers are, but
no, you're right.
I feel like it's gotta be 50. It's gotta be close to half, right?
You're right. Yeah. They started buying Bitcoin last year, or NFTs or like, they just have no idea what it's like to have what is now a huge percentage of their wealth just evaporated.
And the corollary would be, I remember when I first was getting into this, like I had no way to discern like Litecoin from Bitcoin. Like I didn't put in the work. I had no idea.
Sure.
I was like, oh, that makes sense. So, you know, you go through the cycle and then all of a sudden the floor falls out on the other coins. Look, it falls out on Bitcoin too, but it falls out to a much lesser degree. And you start to dig around and you see that there's this like Bitcoin community. And like, that's really where I learned everything I learned about Bitcoin was during that bear market, where I found a core group of people who cared about like the way it would change the world and not necessarily the short-term dollar price. And that is something that you kind of lose today because everybody's like, why would I deal with Bitcoin? It's like, it's like a dumb rock. It barely moved.
Right.
And I think what's going to happen eventually is there's going to be, who knows? I mean, everybody's like, oh, there's like a super cycle or whatever. I feel like there's going to be bear markets here. And at some point or another, and that's when, you know, shit gets real and, you know, we've seen it before and people lose everything. And a lot of people just leave the industry, right? A lot of those projects die, but then after several more years, like it starts over again and even more aggressively, right? Now, the question is like, whether or not something that feels like today is a bear market, or are we just in like a sideways portion of the bull market, right? I would be inclined to think the latter.
Yeah,
I think that $50,000 Bitcoin is not a bear market.
Not a bear
market.
ETH
is like what, 3,800 or something? I don't know. So I mean, we'll see. I mean, a lot of these altcoins did lose like 40% of their value from their October highs, right? So some of those folks are feeling that. But the point is that I think long term, what I believe is that we will always have a explosion of new projects in this sort of like, let's say, token space. We're always going to have, you know, we've seen ICOs, we've seen NFTs, we've seen new ways of like creating value. We've seen like a million different blockchains come up. And, you know, I think that what ends up happening is we're probably going to have a lot more, you know, crypto projects in the future than we do today. And I think that eventually that's where Bitcoin starts to separate. That would be my thesis. Like, there's a really great paper called Only the Strong Survive by my friend Alan Farrington. It's incredible. And it's like the long-term investment approach to Bitcoin and why his particular investment firm is very focused on Bitcoin. And, you know, I think today you're still looking at, there's this like Bitcoin dominance metric, which is quite easily manipulatable because it's kind of like looking at market cap. And if anyone knows much about crypto, they know that market cap is quite easily manipulatable because you can basically mint a coin and come to a deal with an exchange for the exchange to list your coin at a starting price. And then it kind of, and all of a sudden, you know, let's say Davis and Alex come up with a crypto and we mint a billion of them and they're worth like some fraction of a cent. Oh, all of a sudden we have $30 million, right? This is like literally how it works. So the what we see is like in a frothy market with easy money, right? Like with asset inflation, it's kind of like a microcosm of the real economy here in crypto. We have a lot of this like Potemkin village stuff going on where value is like way over, everything's overvalued. Over time, I think what ends up happening is there's going to be a series of these cycles and stuff's still going to be very valuable. But I think Bitcoin over time becomes like more valuable because it's like the one thing that cannot be manipulated when it comes to its like monetary rule set and issuance. So in a sea of like ever expanding virtual stuff, some of which is valuable and some of which is not, most of which is not. I mean, obviously if you go to CoinMarketCap today, 99.9% of those coins are scams. Like, you know, we could meaningfully talk about, if we're charitable, several dozen, right? That's about it, right? Out of 5,000. So we're talking about this like sea of space junk, virtual junk that we're floating through. And I think just like over time, that's where Bitcoin gets more and more and more valuable. It's hard to imagine because like all we have is the last few years to look at. And you're kind of like, well, how could that possibly be? Like, where could Bitcoin go from here? The Bitcoin bulls, and I'm one of them, what we believe will end up happening is that Bitcoin will start to like eat other asset classes. And I don't mean Litecoin or Solana or ETH. I mean, Bitcoin.
No, like real asset classes.
Yeah. Like we're talking gold, which has a market cap, like 10 trillion, you know? Okay. So Bitcoin's at about a trillion right now, more or less, depending on when this recording comes out, we'll just call it somewhere around $1 trillion dollars. So right now, Bitcoin's 1/10 of gold. So people like me believe that over the next decade, maybe longer, but probably around a decade, Bitcoin's basically going to eat 8/10 of that. I mean, gold will still be very valuable. It has industrial use cases, but it won't be nearly as valuable as it is today. So people like me believe that Bitcoin will completely sort of demonetize gold. We also believe it'll start eating into real estate, which is a global market of, depending on how you measure it, $30, $40, $50 trillion. Essentially, what we believe is that houses are valuable, of course, but because our money sucks and our money loses value, our fiat currency, dollars, yen, euros, and of course, all the ones that most citizens of the world have to use, the Naira, the Bolivar, et cetera, the Lira, Turkish Lira. Because our money sucks, we can't like store our earnings and wages in money.
We have
to put them somewhere else. And a common area to do that is real estate. Now, again, what we think is that Bitcoin will not only start eating into gold, it'll start eating into real estate, and it'll capture a large percentage of that. Now, it won't obviously it won't capture all of it, or maybe even, you know, who knows how much, but like homes will always be valuable. The people like me just believe they'll become sort of less valuable as a, as an investment. You'll prefer Bitcoin. It's liquid. Like selling a house is a fucking nightmare. You can immediately sell your Bitcoin and it can teleport anywhere in the world. That will become clear over time. We also believe it will eat into the largest market of the three I'm mentioning here between gold, real estate. We think it'll eat into government debt, into bonds. And there's tens of trillions of dollars of government debt around the world. And it's all negative yielding, meaning the inflation rate of the currency is higher than the interest rate. So this is what we call financial repression. So currently, if you're sitting on like, and I know your listeners probably aren't, but the institutions that they use, like the banking system is, they're sitting on these like government securities or even, you know, less risky sort of corporate debt. All of these bonds like are basically either making close to zero or they're losing money for their customers over time. So you start to look at Bitcoin, is it gonna generate 200% return every year? Probably not. It only did about 90% this year, 100%. But like, that's a lot better than negative 2%, right? So what we believe is that over the next decade, institutional investors and sovereigns will start to realize that Bitcoin's basically less risky. Like today they view it as very risky and they view sovereign, like US debt essentially is risk-free. It's the risk-free asset.
Right.
What we believe is that like over time, Bitcoin will be seen as free asset and then everything else will be based off that. Now, again, in that world, there's still gonna be all these other things I mentioned, uses for all of the traditional asset classes, plus all the crypto ones. I think the debate I've posed to people like Raoul Paul and others is, well, if because all these people, most people who are crypto bulls are Bitcoin bulls also, right? So the question is, if they believe in Bitcoin and they think it's gonna start to eat bonds and real estate and gold, which again, people like Eric Voorhees and Raoul Paul like absolutely agree, well, why wouldn't it start to eat other crypto too, would be my question. Because I feel like a lot of this other crypto is gonna be less valuable as financial collateral in the future. Some of the games that like propagate its value will be exposed and the market will learn over time. And you know, we will see. But I think it's quite possible we're living in a moment right now as you and I speak where Bitcoin is kind of like a dark horse. Like it's kind of a sleeper asset. Like again, most
there's,
people
there's nothing got to it, there's no news, right? You know, there's
yeah,
no
it's like,
there, yeah.
But like most people, especially younger people who got into it today, I mean, they're almost like Bitcoin's boring, right?
Right.
And you know, I think that those people who can like dig in a little deeper and start to understand what actually is Bitcoin and start to realize that Bitcoin's not competing with these other cryptos. It's something totally different. I'll give an example. Like when we look at like the money structure of the world, like pre-Bitcoin, what you had is something called a money hierarchy. And it's like at the top, you start with either gold in the gold standard or today central bank reserves. And the like most valuable of them all is the US dollar, right? So at the very top, you'd have sort of like liabilities of the Federal Reserve. And then from there, the next level down would be like other national debt, other national liabilities. You'd start with the euro, the Japan, you know, Japanese debt. You go down to other sovereigns, you'd start introducing corporate debt. You would start introducing deposits at banks. You would start introducing money market, mutual funds, things like that. And then at the bottom, you start getting into credit and derivatives and things like that. So it's basically like a hierarchy where the thing that's closest to being risk-free is at the top, and at the very bottom are like the riskiest things, like shady corporate debt and you know different kinds of derivatives, financial engineering, etc. You're gonna see that emerge as well in the crypto space, and Bitcoin will be, in my view, like the ultimate monetary good at the top of the hierarchy, and then you'll go down from there. Now, as you saw this year, the biggest short-term returns are going to be in the riskiest asset classes. And that,
yeah, that's a tale as old as time.
Yeah. And, we're watching that happen. Right. So meme coins, which are literally created as a joke, are destroying everything else. And I think that's probably a sign of of too much easy money in the market. And I don't know whether or not, I don't know whether that's just sort of something that was going to happen in crypto anyway, or whether that's a symptom of what our government is doing. I was looking at this statistic the other day. There's a new book coming out that you and your listeners might be interested in next month called The Lords of Easy Money. And it's kind of like a left-wing perspective, a left-wing criticism of the monetary policy of the US government over the last few decades, written by a guy who's investigated the Kochs and things like that. But basically, there's an essay out now, which is like a sample chapter, and it's called The Fed's Doomsday Prophet Has a Dire Warning About Where We're Headed. It's on Politico, and it's a chapter of the book, and it's talking about a central banker who worked at one of the big central bank arms, who was warning against this post-Great Financial Crisis, this policy of just like basically creating more money to buy assets from the private sector. And the quote I'm going to read is that between 2008 and 2014, the Federal Reserve printed more than $3.5 trillion in new bills. To put that in perspective, it's roughly triple the amount of money that the Fed created in its first 95 years of existence. So obviously since 2014, we've created more money than had previously existed to that. So we kind of keep going exponential. And you know, that is what people like me believe has led to massive asset inflation and things like real estate, as well as like rising inflation and things like.
So then, what do you say to Bitcoin, opponents who say, well, Bitcoin is no different than any of these other asset classes, and its valuation is just as fake, which is not something I believe, but it would be something that opponents would say.
Well, I think it's a great point. And first we would look at the facts. So if Bitcoin is this asset that's going to be like something you'd want to own in a time of inflation, then you'd expect it to go up, right? Well, gold has long been like billed as this like hedge against inflation, right? Gold is flat in the last decade. If you were like loading into gold 10 years ago, sorry, bro, like you're kind of flat. Now this is lost because people who fairly so, because like, hey, I mean, we're only gonna make decisions based on what we see personally, right? But what's often lost is that Bitcoin is the best performing crypto of all of them of all time, based on when it first had a monetary value to its value today. Bitcoin is the financially most impressive cryptocurrency, beating out even Shiba Inu and all this other stuff. That's lost because it took time, because it took a decade.
Right.
But if you actually consider that it performed better than any other financial asset in history during this time of inflation, that's not bad. I think the fair question to ask of all these new assets that are being created is like, what's their shelf life going to be? How are they going to perform 5, 6, 7 years later? Like, I feel like we're coming up against that wall with Ethereum too. Like, I have friends who participated in the pre-sale for Ethereum, who got Ethereum at $6, $7, friends who bought it at $50, $100. They're pretty happy now at 4,000. But, I think it's a fair question. Does Ethereum go to 10,000 or
what? Yeah, I've already seen this from Solana maxis or Avalanche maxis whatever. They're saying like, you're too late. You're too late on X,
yeah,
y,
I mean,
and Z.
Like, is Ethereum, like, so Solana went up 100x this year, right? Like, even more if you go back to last year. I mean, is it reasonable to expect ETH to go up 100x? I'm not sure. I think there's a case for it. I've seen it. But I think at the end of the day,
if Ethereum becomes like the way you log on to Web3, and Web3 becomes the dominant way that people interact with the internet, maybe.
Yeah. So what people, and I'm trying to like roughly, there is no real Bitcoin community, but there is in a way, right? And I'm trying to generalize them. And me being a part of that, I think what we would believe, generally speaking, is that Ethereum is going to start to get this like serious competition from these more centralized kind of blockchains that make,
because
trade-offs.
People don't care. People do not care about decentralization. Yeah,
and people don't care, And you're going to start seeing developers go to Avalanche and go to Solana because it's easier and they have better scripting languages and they don't have to deal with all this nonsense about like the difficulty bomb and like the proof of stake stuff. Like they can just be natively already where ETH wants to go. So that's, I think Bitcoiners, a lot of us at least believe that you're going to start seeing these like blockchain wars between ETH and these other things, and those other things are going to eat ETH's mind share, talent share, and ultimately capital share. I mean, I'll give you an example. I want to share some of the things that I've been noticing outside of the Bitcoin space that I've been really intrigued by. One of them is stablecoins, and I'll talk more about that in a second. But just to give an example about the ETH versus the other chains. In Nigeria today, Tether is the most widely traded cryptocurrency. It goes Tether, Bitcoin, and a distant third, ETH. Tether runs on a lot of different blockchains, and Tether does not run on Bitcoin anymore. That's where it started. It doesn't run on Ethereum anymore, which is, until recently, was pretty dominant. In Nigeria, it runs on Tron, which is really funny.
That is really funny.
Tron was considered like, it's like joke coin. It is. I mean, it's just a
copy and pasted white paper.
It's a copy and pasted white paper. But the reality is that because it's so centralized and cheap, the trading markets in countries like Nigeria have preferred it to ETH, which, I mean, it would be worth noting, has become essentially unusable for a lot of people, unless you're like got a lot of ETH, unless you're sort of rich in ETH terms. I mean, like if you're trying to do like stuff with $100, couple $100 in the ETH ecosystem,
you literally can't.
It's like, yeah, I mean, like I have a MetaMask wallet and I'm messing around with it and I'm trying to learn and I put in $100 and you basically can't move it. So, and I know that the ETH folks are going to say, don't worry, you know, eventually we're gonna move to ETH2. It's gonna be fun.
But are they though? Like that's another thing is like you hear about ETH2, you hear about proof of stake, and it's like, well, if you guys, it is, you know, I don't know, I'm not even smart enough to get into the betas. Is ETH 100% decentralized or how much central? That doesn't matter. The point is, right now, if you want to do something on Ethereum, it is very expensive, and I say that as someone who uses the Ethereum mainnet. I don't know, 10 times a week probably, and it is expensive. You have to pay a lot of fees, and if I didn't buy Ethereum in like 2015 or whatever, I would not be doing anything on it because I wouldn't even have, like, I wouldn't want to be putting my US dollars in to mess around with it.
Right So there are these like crypto whales again, and you know, they're discussing these things openly, and they're noting that it's not like Ethereum has this like infinite amount of time where they just like take this time. These other chains are going to start, they've already started to eat, not just into value, but also into developers and into the new entrants. Like out of the millions and millions of new people who've come into crypto this year, like a lot of them have skipped Ethereum, right? So, you know, I think if you have this like Bitcoin thesis, we'll put aside the freedom human rights stuff for a second, just pure value. Your thesis is essentially that like over time, there's going to be this like splintering and proliferation of all these other blockchains and all these other projects. And they will start to compete and fight with each other. And in the meantime, this market, this new economy, this crypto economy is going to need this like pristine collateral in the same way that the world needed the US dollar to do what it did over the last 70 years. Like the world needed a common pristine collateral for financial markets and for trade and commerce. And I would argue that was the reason we chose we didn't necessarily choose the dollar. The US government sort of forced it in there. And I've written a lot about that. But the reality is today, the dollar is that sort of like, you know, numeraire for finance and energy and all these things. So in the crypto space, like, you know, currently that's not necessarily the case. Like people basically use stable coins for that purpose. But we will see. I mean, I think that the case again is that long term it's going to be Bitcoin. But I did want to mention that so it's been a weird year. There's been a lot of like, you know, back and forth and you know, toxicity. We can get into that in a second. But I would just say that quickly that like it is definitely a low point like I would say in the public's eyes for Bitcoin right now. And that's a great time to learn about it and get into it and learn about what it is. As far as like what I'm interested beyond Bitcoin, I tweeted this recently, but I think that three really impressive achievements of the altcoin space have been stablecoins. I mean, you have $150 billion of stablecoins today, which is amazing. And I'm interested in seeing how that can come to the Bitcoin space. So my organization is like sort of funding a bounty. We did this with Jack Mahler's and Strike, and we talked about it yesterday in Spaces. And we have a one Bitcoin bounty to help incentivize people to come up with a way for like a user on like just a free open source wallet at home, anywhere in the world, to be able to peg their Bitcoin to dollars. We think that's going to be really big, especially in the emerging markets.
Yeah.
It could be really big for finance too. I mean, if you didn't have to rely on like going to exchanges to do all these swaps for stable coins, like if you could just natively peg your Bitcoin to it, that'd be a really big deal. So that's something I'm really interested in. I was in like a bunch of back and forths on this, but like I will certainly concede, and it's impressive that even though like self-custodianship is not like a, it's not exactly like a self-professed value in like the NFT, like Web3 space, it's like a forced reality. Like if you use Meta, you know what I mean? If like you're using MetaMask, you're like self-custodial, right? So I think Bitcoiners would be well to.
Yeah, and apparently everyone who's ever bought a Bored Ape has given away their seed phrase at some point. It is unbelievable how many people in the NFT community have gotten hacked. Like, you definitely do not hear that same stuff.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable to me.
Well, and that's a good point. What I'm saying is that the upside would be that the NFT community and phenomenon has encouraged people actually hold their own keys. However, the philosophy of the community has been such that like, that's not really a priority. It's just, they have to do it.
They just have to do it.
And as soon as they can find a way to not have to do it, they'll fucking not have to do it. Right. You look at like centralized NFT providers and platforms, and like, I'm willing to bet that a lot. And I spoke to someone who's like, who just joined one of the big kind of crypto VC firms. And you know, he's all about like, you know, this is like the vision for NFTs. I mean, he's like, A, they're not going to live on decentralized chains. They're going to be on totally centralized chains. And for B, sure. I don't really think, and he doesn't think that really people are going to hold their own keys. Let's put it that way.
No.
So that we'll see, but that's one potential avenue. But I would point that out. That's been an interesting phenomenon, is like rise of people holding their own assets.
Even learning about holding your own assets, even learning that it's a possibility, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the third one would be that NFT concept, which, I mean, look, again, like I would think that even the most hardened Bitcoiner would have to admit that it's kind of cool that if you live in like Cuba or Iran or whatever, and you're an artist, like that you could create art and sell it. I think where the dispute would be, like, do you really need to use an NFT to do it? Or could you just like sell your work and then receive, you know, payment for it? I think there's the argument there. But I do think that that's been like a pretty inarguable phenomenon. So stablecoins, NFTs, and self-custodial digital assets have been, I think, really interesting to watch from my perspective. And, you know, I think that the whole toxicity thing in Bitcoin, I think where it, one of the reasons I've been so interested in it is because we're in this, like, to borrow the Game of Thrones lingo, we're in this sort of summer right now. Like, things are cool and groovy, and the prices are booming and everything's cool. When it gets to like the depths, though, things get pretty dicey, like in the history of this space. And, you know, that's sort of when some of these attacks may come. I don't know what, you know, we're not sure exactly what they look like in the future. But in the past, you know, in 2015 and 16, during that bear market, and there's a great book on this called The Block Size War, which I would encourage folks to
I bought it after the last time you came on, but I haven't read it yet, but it's sitting there.
It's really, really good. And it's a chronicle of like the conflict. War is probably obviously an exaggeration. Nobody died, but it was a conflict in how Bitcoin would scale. Like, basically, would it scale in a way where they would make these blocks bigger and bigger and bigger, where you would eventually need like data centers to run Bitcoin servers. but you could like do a lot more transactions and you know, basically these payment companies could make a lot more money? Or would it scale in a way where like the base chain would be slow kind of forever, relatively speaking, and you would have to use these second layers, but you would preserve the decentralization and freedom of the network and the auditability of the Bitcoin sort of 21 million ethos. And remarkably, the latter won out, sort of very David and Goliath. You had Coinbase and all the Chinese billionaire miners, and you can look this up. It was called the New York Agreement, but you basically had all the biggest kind of like actors in the space try to force through a change in Bitcoin to like increase the block size. This was called SegWit 2X, and it was done through something you can still read today called the New York Agreement, a consensus in 2017, New York City. It was all sort of hammered out. But this like online grassroots group of people that I would describe as toxic, like played a major role in helping stop it by creating like an online movement to resist this.
Which I think after hearing you say that, like, yeah. I saw you, I don't remember if I heard it on a space or whatever. I actually think you're right. I think that's where the seeds of like the Ethereum is a shit coin, fix the money, fix the world. If you buy I right click saved your NFT, like, which is just so clearly a willful ignorance thing from some people. Like, obviously, you know, it's not true.
Right.
You just do it to trigger people. And like, I think you're right. That's where it all comes from. Well, is that I moment. Mean,
well, the book does a good job of explaining that the DAO, really the, like, okay, creation
the
of
DAO
Ethereum
hack.
Right. So the creation of Ethereum is one thing. Again, a lot of Bitcoiners got into Bitcoin because they didn't like the fact that the US government and other governments could essentially print money out of thin air and reward it to their friends. And we could have this corrupt world where like the rich got richer and kind of at the expense of the average person. That is encoded in the first block of the Bitcoin blockchain. And that's why Bitcoin's a political revolution. And, you know, so the rise of ETH and the sale of ETH to insiders, to people like Joe Lubin, was, you know, against their ethos. And I don't, again, some of it was cope, fine. I mean, sure. It'd be hard to argue that that at least some of it wasn't cope over the price going up so much.
Sure.
But I think a lot of it was like, no, this is, you know, basically bullshit. And there's a good interview on Peter McCormick's show with a guy named Lane Rettig, who used to work for the Ethereum Foundation. It's actually a two-part interview. I'd recommend listening to it. Lane's a really thoughtful guy. I went to El Salvador with Lane. He's great. So Lane left the Ethereum Foundation basically because he said he didn't want to pump Joe Lubin's bags. You know, that's kind of like the idea. So some people are in this for real political reasons, not just to make cash quickly. And I think that, you know, that was the first big thing that upset Bitcoin community. But the second one was the DAO, right? So the whole point of these blockchains is that they're supposed to be like immutable. You know, there was an experiment in fundraising and investing called the DAO in, you know, in 2016 in Ethereum. And it didn't turn out well. It got hacked. A lot of money got stolen. And there's all this like evidence that shows that like Vitalik and the handful of people that basically, you know, obviously Ethereum's like slightly less centralized today, but like at the time they were basically able to like tell people to stop trading and shut down everything, and they were able to kind of force through a hard fork, creating two coins: Ethereum Classic, which is where the stolen coins were still stolen, and Ethereum as we know it today, where the stolen coins were like basically returned. And that was like original sin kind of thing from the Bitcoin community. They look at that and they're like, oh, well, that's not why we got into this, right? So the DAO,
which goes to the larger point that people don't care. Most people would actually probably prefer that if their money got stolen, that they would want to be able to be returned. Like people who get hacked tweeted OpenSea, like, give me my money back. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's extremely fair. And that's why you're seeing the ETH community start to sort of splinter now in terms of like, what should its priorities be? And I think, you know, look, to be honest, like this is, the writing has been on the wall the whole time for Ethereum to become more centralized. I mean, the whole proof of stake thing, at the end of the day, and like, neither of us are tremendously technical, I'll assume.
Correct.
At the end of the day, what you have is a system where proof of stake is essentially an oligarchic system where, like, the more asset you have, the more power you have and influence you have. And in Bitcoin, that's not the case, which is why I like it so much. The protocol does not discriminate based on your wealth or how much Bitcoin you have. It doesn't give you like any extra rights. And that's very important to me.
Do you, what would you make of the statement then that Ethereum and Bitcoin are actually not trying to address the same markets and that they can
agree,
exist?
I would agree.
Yeah. That, which is always my thing. With I have some friends who are ETH maxis, right? Who are like, why do you own the Petrock coin? Why don't you sell it? And I have friends who are Bitcoin maxis who are like, I cannot believe you would spend your wealth on ETH or on JPEGs of cats. They're like, I can't believe you would do this. And my thing is that I don't even necessarily view them as competing. I would never sell my Bitcoin for anything, but I've sold Ethereum and I've spent my Ethereum, you know, it's different.
Yeah. Well, I would say that today they don't compete,
but they used to.
They used to, and I think they will in the, like, I don't even, I'm not sure how, we'll see how long Ethereum lasts. I'm not sure, but what I'm, part of the bull thesis in Bitcoin, as really eloquently stated in Only the Strong Survive by Alan Farrington, is essentially that, like, all of the cool features that people loved about ETH originally and essentially are now flocking to these other chains to use and do will eventually come to Bitcoin also. And this is the bull.
I hope so.
I
would love that. I would love for DeFi protocols to exist on Bitcoin.
Yeah. And I think that the most honest debate in the space has been a debate over utilitarianism, right? Kind of like, or utility, let's say. Like, taking what you just said, it's kind of like a lot of people in the space are like, well, great. I look forward to the day when Bitcoin can be this really efficient protocol for NFTs and for decentralized exchange, for smart contracts, for stable coins. Like, that'll be great and I'll use it then. But in the meantime, I'm going to use these other things. And I think that's where you get the fissure.
That's kind of what I think is like, if I could park all this money and do these things with Bitcoin, I would rather do that.
Yeah. And I think that there are pros and cons to the community of people who are basically like, nah, like you shouldn't do it at all. You know, cause like these other coins are bad. I think
that's cope to me, that is the Bitcoin people coping because a lot of those people would proclaim to be libertarians, right? Or like really hardcore, like Mises, Austrian economics.
Sure. Yeah.
And under that sort of broad political philosophy, it would sort of be like your deal would be, you know, adults entering into mutual consenting agreements should not be subject to, undue criticism, right? Like they would be like, you know, I said this on the show last week, like under that, it's like, it's like your right to be scammed, right? That like, literally
okay. So I think there's some valid cons. But there are also some there are some legitimate criticisms, of course, that you've just laid out and that I think most of us would agree with. But there's also some reasons why it's actually kind of important that I've tried to argue in terms of why are some of us still kind of focused militantly kind of on Bitcoin? I've been laying those out in a variety of sort of environments, dialogues, but it's not really my main focus, but like if people are going to ask me about it, I'll talk about it. Fine. It's the same thing with Jack Dorsey. Like, it's not like his, from what I understand, and it's not like I did get to interview him earlier this year, and I was able to spend some time with him. But like, I'm just projecting here. I don't think Jack really wants to spend his time criticizing Web3. I think he wants to do what he's doing. I think he wants to build. But like, if he's going to be pressed on it, then you'll have to explain yourself, right? And that's what you saw him do.
I'm cool with, because that's authentic. Like I think Jack can look at it as a builder and lots of people like him and be like, this is actually not a good way to build a system.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, and I'm cool with that. I'm cool with that as a reason for not liking these things. That's very, that's, I think to me, that's very different.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, it's like people like me believe Bitcoin's like the most important innovation in the world, and that it's going to be key to a digital future where we have human rights and we have freedoms. And it'll help break apart some of this like horribly corrupt system we live in. And kind of based on that, two things. Number one, if you're not Bitcoin only, then you know you're going to spend all this time and effort on these like kind of like what we would consider temporary solutions. And
for
that's,
sure,
you know, all that energy is not going to Bitcoin, right? So there's a precious amount of developers, there's a precious amount of time, there's a precious amount of energy being spent on Bitcoin because it doesn't pay like it pays to work for these altcoins, which have like infinite marketing budgets. So it is, you know, ultimately having a Bitcoin only focus, you know, people like me consider to be very healthy for Bitcoin for that reason. Which is why, you know, I think companies like, well, I guess now it's called Block, but essentially, you know, Square and all of its stuff, I think is really good for Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin Magazine is good for Bitcoin. I think the Bitcoin Conference is good for Bitcoin. I think that Cash App is good for Bitcoin because they focus on Bitcoin and they help like educate people about Bitcoin. I think they're better for Bitcoin than Coinbase and Binance and Consensus and,
Coinbase doesn't even want Bitcoin to win.
Well, you know, the argument goes, well, Coinbase and Binance like onboard a lot more people. That might be true. But they also try to sell you
grid coin and like, well, they're
trying to sell you fucking Bitcoin Cash, which is a fraudulent, you know, fake Bitcoin. So, you know, I think that that's where I would start to disagree and say that's taking it too far. Like that these other exchanges and entities being bigger are better. No, I don't think that it works like that. I think that having a Bitcoin focus is healthy for Bitcoin, number one. And number two, I think it's like going back to why Bitcoin was created. I think it's, you know, again, not from a financial point of view. No one could possibly argue that Bitcoin's been like the best asset to hold over the last couple of years. That's obviously, you know, not anywhere true. You can argue that politically speaking, it is kind of like almost like a righteous technology, and it's really cool and fun to be working on and very important for people around the world in a way that like Shiba Inu's not, right? So I don't know. I think that the Bitcoin only focus is really healthy and good. And I do think that in like 10 years, a lot of people are going to like wish they had bought more Bitcoin. That's like something I believe. Yeah.
100%.
And, you know, and that's where we're going to start. You know, if we do this show in 10 years, there's going to be all this stuff about like, I wish I had told my family, I wish I had done this, I wish I had done that. And, you know, I'm always debating these like, you know, prominent altcoin people about this. And like, look, you know, I think, again, there's some really interesting innovations happening in that space that I think can come to Bitcoin. But at the end of the day, I think like long-term, the Bitcoin thesis does believe that Bitcoin will actually be the best asset of all of them over time. And that's something that I think that even a lot of the folks that are like super anti-Bitcoin maximalists like also would agree on, right? So I think at the end of the day, the debates recently over the last 4 or 5 months, as we've sort of discussed here, that weren't around really a year ago, or at least weren't very loud. I think they come at a time when the market moves sideways, where people are frustrated. Like even if you remember, even in October, we had like October or whatever. People were like pretty happy. There wasn't as much fighting, you know?
Sure.
So I think when the market moves sideways, you get like, you know, people just get salty, they get copy, whatever it is. And that's going to get real bad if we go into like a multi-year sort of, let's say, bear market situation.
Right.
But, look, that's the kind of climate I started to really get into Bitcoin. So I feel like that'll mint a whole bunch of new people who wanna actually fix the money.
That is like a more enjoyable. If you're really in it for the ideology, that's like almost a more enjoyable time to be a Bitcoiner, because you don't like. I guarantee you, when the price tanks, we're not going to have to deal with any more, you know, fucking Elon tweets or whatever.
It's tough. I mean, I remember I used to do lecturing for like corporate leaders through this thing called Singularity University. And I gave a talk about Bitcoin. This was like 2017, 2018. And I mean, I'm up there in front of all these people. And I was like, I mean, some of these conferences were like 1500 people in the audience. It was huge things. And I'm talking about Bitcoin, and you know, they're probably looking at, they're like, Bitcoin's at like $3,000. It crashed. Like,
yeah. Who cares?
Who's this moron? You know? You know, of course now I hope, you know, I hope they had just bought some freaking Bitcoin.
Hope they listened. Yeah.
Like, but probably not. And it's difficult though. It is difficult during that bear market to achieve, you know, wider education. But I think partially we've achieved liftoff from that. Even if the price continues to sink for like a couple of years here, like there's such a big community now of people globally that care about this and that where it really matters for them. You look at how far Bitcoin has gone down from its high. It's like, okay, well, two things. Like, first of all, in a lot of countries, the national fiat currency has gone down even more. And these aren't countries where it's like easy to get dollars. You know, a lot of people who are listening are probably like, well, why wouldn't you just get dollars? Well, you know, why don't you go to Lebanon and try to get your hands on some dollars? Okay. So not so easy. So, but it is easy to get Bitcoin. Like I could send it, in fact, from my living room right now, to you right now, you know, and this is the revolution. But the other thing, you know, is that the mainstream media often forgets is that we're up, whatever we're up, like 10x in 18 months. And, you know, I'm not talking about Shiba Inu here. I'm talking about actual Bitcoin. Like this thing, which has these communities around the world that a lot of these other coins don't really have. You know, the other part of this is this like network effect. Like it's like amazing. You can
massive.
Go to like Minsk,
yeah.
You know, like Minsk in Belarus, or like you could be in Kingston, Jamaica, or you can be in Lagos, or I mean, everybody knows what Bitcoin is, and you can sell it for fiat currencies. And these like peer-to-peer markets are just so fascinating to me. So I think that it's a tough time to promote the Bitcoin only thesis right now. I think probably one of the tougher times at the sort of let's say later stages of these bull markets. People don't want to hear it. Like they're like, obviously it's wrong. Like look at the prices. If you have only stayed in Bitcoin, you've lost a lot of money.
Sure.
And you know what? Like that might be true if you knew what you were doing and you sold at the right times, or if you were an insider and you got like into the Solana pre-deal or whatever,
right.
Fine. And you're correct, right? But like my response is essentially that like that activity that allowed you to get those gains, you know, is kind of almost what we're fighting against, like in the Bitcoin space. Like we don't want there to be like that easy money situation. Now, I will say that one of the valid criticisms of that has to do with investor laws in the United States. And this is where, when I was originally getting to this space, I was like, oh, fuck yeah. Like it's such BS that like you have to have $1 million in assets or make like 300 grand a year to invest in startups, right?
Yeah.
Which is just like insane, right? So that's where the ICO originally, it starts to, you know, it originally appears like morally like better, right? Like, oh, well, anyone can get in. And that's a good point, and that's worth reflecting on.
Yeah, honestly, like people calling for the SEC to like get involved with Ethereum as like a security or whatever, like that's so lame. That's so lame.
I would agree that people calling for it is lame, but people pointing out that the SEC will go after it most
is
likely
fair.
Is the brutal truth in my view. I did a show with crypto with Kobe and with Udi Wertheimer and a few other people
love,
on Peter's
love,
show.
Love Udi. Udi's thoughts on all of this stuff.
Yeah, Udi
represent and, are aligned to mine for sure.
And Kobe as well. But we had like a nice, that guy Alan Farrington was with us, and it's a good show. And we talk about this. And at the end of the day, it's like, I think all of us agreed that like in 10 years, we're all going to wish we had bought more Bitcoin. Like it's the long-term safest asset to hold.
Yes.
I just think there's that disagreement over like, how short term, to what extent you want to be involved in it, and what kind of like in essentially like injustices or inequalities it's recreating. Like one of the reasons why I'm so skeptical of a lot of this stuff is it almost like it recreates some of the things that we got upset about Wall Street or Silicon Valley about, but like on steroids, like if like the insiders of these coins, and this is why the Web3 stuff is coming under such scrutiny with, thankfully with Jack leading the charge, is because like, look, it's one thing if you just want to say, I want to make as much money as possible. We're going to mint these coins and dump them on retail or whatever. And great, go ahead. It's a free market. You do whatever you want. But when these VCs start saying that not only are we going to do that, but it's going to be this like liberating force for humanity.
That's yeah, don't do that. Don't. Why do we have to lie? Why is lying? Why do we have to lie?
So that's what really, I think, triggers people like Jack, who I would say are really reasonable Bitcoin. Bitcoin maximalist term was invented by Vitalik. So I hate using it because it's absurd. It was invented by Vitalik to criticize people who didn't want to participate in his freaking thing, right. Which, and I think to this day, there are lots of legitimate reasons to not want to do that. But he makes that term, but we'll use it because it's, you know, it's been popularized. So for a Bitcoin maximalist, which by the way, there's a good Bitcoin maximalist show with Andreas Antonopoulos, who most people would not consider certainly a Bitcoin maximalist. I mean, the guy wrote a book on Ethereum, but there's a really good show that he did a few years ago with Stefan Lavera, who is a Bitcoin maximalist, about this idea. And essentially what they were basically saying is like, Andreas was like, yeah, I think a Bitcoin maximalist would believe that in the future, Bitcoin will be kind of be like the dominant currency. And that's no longer the definition on the street, right?
I believe that, and I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist. Yeah.
That's why I'm saying it's no longer the definition on the street. The definition would be that not only do you believe that Bitcoin will be dominant, but that you basically anywhere from critical of to
you only need stake, right? Ethereum is a shit coin. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a spectrum there, which I think that everybody in the Bitcoin community would fall on. And I think there's an extreme end of that spectrum, which is not helpful if it becomes like actually just straight up mean and alienating. That sucks. What I would say is that this phenomenon has been helpful in Bitcoin's history. Like, go read the block size wars. Being kind of fierce at times has protected Bitcoin. People who are intransigent about Bitcoin's policies have protected it over time, and they will continue to do so in the future. I think at the end of the day, the big debate is over just like whether or not, you know, for me, it's been over like the VC stuff has been what I'm most interested in terms of like these people like Chris Dixon going out there and saying Web3 is going to be, it's going to free everybody and it's going to make you own your own data. And I just think that's so sanctimonious given that he's the one who's going to be freaking owning the tokens that build the system. Right. And they just don't disclose that shit, right? So that's really what frustrates
me. I'm 100% on board with you there. We don't have to act like we're reinventing the wheel.
I'll give you an example that people can look at. Like, and it's no longer as, it used to be the biggest and most exciting project in Ethereum, something called DAI and MakerDAO. This was like maybe 2-3 years ago. It was like the first algorithmic stablecoin. People were like, it was going gaga over it, right? Today it's like not as an important project. Today we have much more exciting stuff like Uniswap or whatever. But at the time, it was really, really important. And what happened was so interesting because essentially DAI has two coins to the system. There's a stablecoin, and then there's a governance coin called Maker, MKR. And the Maker coin, which was much more valuable than obviously the dollar stablecoin, it was hundreds or even thousands of dollars. Maker coin was like divvied up amongst a bunch of VCs. And the whole point was that the Maker coin holders could vote in a governance structure on the rules of the stablecoin. For example, like what it's pegged to, interest rates, stuff like that. Okay. What ends up happening is that the average holder of the Maker is buying it in a retail sense for investment, doesn't participate in the governance stuff. And what ended up happening was like a handful of VCs like kind of controlled the fate of this project. And that actually almost was like a big problem because, and this may not necessarily be as true today, but like there was a time when that though they could essentially control the fate of Ethereum. Because if if the devs or the community wanted to go in a particular direction and it was going to sort of like be bad for the maker governance holders, they could basically hold everybody else over a barrel and in a way that like approximates almost like a cartel. So this kind of behavior is possible in these crypto systems that are not proof of work, that are not based on actually expending energy in a fair sense. And that's something that I think is 100% a valid criticism, is not talked about enough. And as we enter this next year where we are going to be talking more about owning our own data and Web3s, like Web3, whatever it is. I mean, no one can even define what it is really. I mean, we could make a stab.
Everyone would say, what is it? Different. I would say it's logging in and interfacing with the internet via a wallet instead of, you know, an email login. That to me, that's kind of as simple as it is.
Okay. So yeah. And then like the metaverse and whatever that is, like we're going to be entering into a world where at least these buzzwords are just like more, more common.
We're gonna be treated to politicians saying MetaMask or whatever, which is like no one wants that.
I mean, dude, we're already to the point where some of these, you know, they're all talking about Bitcoin or whatever. I think that these debates are gonna be important to have, and I think they're fair and they're important to consider. If you actually care about owning your own data as opposed to just making a bunch of money, I think those are two very legitimate things that you can set out and do. I think that one of them is a really strong leg to stand on. Like, look, if you can go and time that market and you have more time to burn on this than most people, you can make a lot of money, especially if you're an insider VC. You're going to make unfathomable amounts of money, and you already have. But if you're trying to like actually fix the system and create something that isn't controlled by a small group of people, I guess I just haven't seen it in the rest of the crypto space yet.
Yeah.
I might be using like a very high bar here, but that's why I got into Bitcoin in the first place. And that's why I continue to work on it. And I continue to have this focus on it, even though it's been like wrecked in the last year, let's say, by the other coins. And I feel I feel a lot more excited about it, honestly, today than even a year ago when we were in that bull market. It was so exciting because I've seen like the potential over this last year. I've done a lot of writing and research and interviewing people all around the world. And I've seen them tell me what Bitcoin means to them. And you can say what you want about Solana or Shiba Inu or even ETH, but like, I mean, you got people in like countries in Africa that are still like financially colonized by the French, and you have the Palestinians who are still like, you know, they all have to use the Israeli currency and all this stuff. And they're talking about Bitcoin as like a way out, as like this neutral currency that anyone in the world has equal access to.
Right.
It's really inspiring stuff. And that will always be there, like regardless of whatever happens with Web3. You know, like I think with the guy who came out with that absurd WorldCoin project, Sam Altman, he had a poll the other day. And he said, what's going to be more important in 10 years, like store of value or Web3? And it's like, I mean, he ended up getting ratioed on his poll. I think he was assuming but the idea that like it could only a wealthy person, only a super, super rich person could possibly imagine that store of value wouldn't be like something that's important in the future.
Yeah.
That's like the whole Davos, like you're not going to own anything and you're going to be happy about it stuff. Like you could like, that's not, this is just so detached from like the average existence of a human on this planet where like they actually need a way to store their wages, right? So I continue to be super, super excited about Bitcoin, even in this sideways market, even when the youth look down on it as a boomer coin or whatever. And I'm excited to keep seeing what happens. And I think the next decade is extremely bright for it. So yeah.
I'm with you.
It's a fun time, man.
It is. It is a fun time. I think I sometimes, because I don't love the have fun, staying poor stuff. That is very against the ethos.
That's regrettable. Yeah, that's regrettable.
And I also think like you know, I very rarely begrudge people, especially individuals versus corporations, getting their money. Like, I'm not going to be mad at someone for making, you know, a generational wealth off of a JPEG of a cartoon animal or whatever. And so I just feel like so much gets lost. But I wanted to have you on because on the last show, Brian Hooper and I talked a lot about kind of being let down by the Bitcoin community, but I wanted to be very clear. Like, I love Bitcoin. I will always love Bitcoin. I'm never getting rid of it. Like, well, I'm never selling it. Like, I will always love it.
Yeah. It's going to be digital real estate in the future, and you're going to want your kids and your grandkids and stuff to have it. Like, we cannot say that about like monkey JPEGs or Solana. Correct. Or whatever. We just can't.
Yeah.
I will note though, that although the have fun staying poor, I think, you know, poor taste, but you realize that.
But you've all been warned. You've all been warned, though.
No. I was the reason it was invented was specifically for journalists. So
yes,
I will dig into this for a second. Like, the media have gaslit the American people about Bitcoin for like.
Oh yeah, big problem.
And they've been telling the American people that Bitcoin is dangerous and risky. When in reality, it was dangerous and risky to not have Bitcoin, right? So. Just so people are sort of aware, the point of the intended target of Have Fun Staying Poor was establishment journalists and billionaires like Mark Cuban, who didn't understand Bitcoin. It was kind of like a ironic joke. And then, you know, and then it went too far, and it's not even that popular these days.
No.
For a few months it was going, and it was going because of all the people who had hated on Bitcoin. So I believe
we're not having fun staying poor.
Right. Then they're especially not. I mean, they hate this other stuff even more. I mean, I came out with a take the other day, based on what I've seen in my research, that Tether is like really important to people in like Lebanon and Cuba and stuff. And the financial establishment hates this take because they just think Tether is this Ponzi scheme, right?
Sure.
And it's like, maybe it is, but like, we don't know that for sure. Like, the fact is that it's,
I mean, there's been, like, there's people have tried to prove that Tether is fake or a Ponzi for like, is like since like three bull cycles ago.
Dude, there was some German foundation that put out like a bounty. Like, and I'm like, this is sort of misanthropic. Like, what bounty? Like, what are you doing to help people in Lebanon?
Nothing. Right.
And it's almost, it's like a microcosm of the whole like Bitcoin hater thing, which maybe we can conclude with in terms of.
Sure.
It's going to get worse because of all these other coins. And something is interesting. My general response to like people who are like hating on Bitcoin is like, well, what are you doing for people in Palestine and Cuba? Nothing. Like, Bitcoin's going to do more for human rights today than you are in your entire lifetime. Right. That's just like,
yeah,
for sure. But what we're starting to see now, which is a little dangerous, is the other like sort of big companies like FTX, Coinbase, you know, they're all going to be very pro proof of stake coin, right? Because they can get in there and they can rent seek. They can rent seek, right?
Oh, yeah.
They can be in there at the creation of these things, and they make a lot more money off of that stuff. And proof of stake coins are much more friendly for regulators. So it can basically be controlled. So what you're seeing is like FTX, Coinbase, and the Ethereum Foundation, these are just three of the biggest brands in crypto, easily, right? Top three of 10, right? Like Ethereum, Coinbase, FTX. If you read their website and you look at like the statements they put out about proof of work and mining, like they're gonna be totally happy to stick a knife in Bitcoin. We saw this in Congress the other week when the Stellar, I forgot Stellar even exists.
It was, I know, I found some, I found some in an old wallet the other day, and I was like, amazing.
Yeah,
amazing, like, anyone still wants this.
But the Stellar people were like, you know, just like the Ripple people, they all go after Bitcoin as a way to promote their own coin. And I think that is another one of these things that drives the sort of toxic Bitcoin stuff, is like, it's a reaction to being attacked, like literally. Toxic Bitcoin maximalism was created, I would argue, as a response to people trying to hijack Bitcoin, big corporations and billionaires trying to hijack it in 2017. And it continues to be like a reaction against censorship and attacks against mining. Like, earlier this year, we saw this. Marathon, a big like corporation, was trying to like censor blocks. And the Bitcoin community was just like, I would say the toxic Bitcoin community was like, nah. And then like, they just had this big resistance against it. And like, they ended up getting the marathon people to like back down. But like, I think you're going to start, you're going to see a lot more proof of work antipathy in the coming year. And I think that's one of the most interesting things about Bitcoin. It's something that I've learned a lot about, is about mining and how important it is, and how, like, honestly, if you care about the planet, like, you got to realize that our current system is totally unsustainable. The way that we use energy, the patterns that we use energy, is totally unsustainable. And the monetary standard that rules the world is connected to oil, as we covered in the last episode, and is connected to fossil fuels. Yep. And all of a sudden now we have this like possible ultimate monetary good and reserve currency that like today is majority renewable, as we, you and I are speaking right now. And if we consider technology deflation, and consider that every year solar and wind and all this stuff gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, I mean, what do you think Bitcoin's going to run on in 2050? It's not going to run on oil. It's going to run on all the, whatever the cheapest energy is. And that's going to be renewables, nuclear, stuff like that. So I'm pretty excited about that future. And that's a big fight. That's going to be a big fight, because I think the users, the artists, the NFT holders are one thing. Like, I don't think, like, you know, Bitcoiners, you know, don't have a beef with them. Bitcoiners have a beef with the creators of these other coins. Sure. Because they're basically anti-Bitcoin. They attack Bitcoin, they criticize Bitcoin, they go out of their way to lobby against it. And, and I think that that's just important to keep in mind, right? Like, the nastiness you see is often a reaction to an attack. So we'll see how that kind of unfolds in the coming year or two. But I, I definitely appreciate the opportunity to come on and discuss this stuff with you. And it's really great to hear that you're still super, I mean, look, I think everybody's still super into Bitcoin, generally speaking.
I hope so.
Yeah. And I appreciate the fact that people are realizing that, like, you know, part of the community, you know, goes too far sometimes. And that's fair. And I get it. Like, you know, people are going to be upset about what they hear, but this is a real fight, man. I mean,
sure.
I mean, Bitcoin's like breaking people's feelings on the internet. Well, the US dollar is like bombing countries and stuff. We're starting
to get to the geopolitical phase. The fight for Bitcoin will be very real with the Federal Reserve, with Congress, with the president.
I mean, like, dude, we have not seen anything yet. And that's interesting, because one thing Bitcoiners could argue is that, like, all the other cryptos, it's going to go one way or the other. Either the creators of them are going to go after Bitcoin and proof of work, which we're starting to see. So that's a possibility. But the other thing that's been interesting for me to notice is that they almost act like a moat for Bitcoin. Like, it is in the best interest of Coinbase and of MetaMask and of the NFT community for it to be like as easy as possible from a regulatory perspective for Americans to own digital assets, right?
Yeah.
In a self-custodial manner. So they're almost going to go, they could care less about Bitcoin. They're going to go to bat for that. And that's going to protect Bitcoin users. And that's really interesting. So I think it
crypto,
goes-
Crypto kind of, needs to be a lobby, and Bitcoin provides a lot of cover there.
Yeah, or rather that Bitcoin doesn't really have a lobby, and that in many ways, crypto is providing the cover for Bitcoin, is I guess what I'm saying.
Right, right.
The little split, and we'll see. I have described how it's also going after Bitcoin in some ways, but at the end of the day, like, if you're using Uniswap, if you're using NFTs, you know, you kind of have to be self-custodial. And if the U.S. government's going to introduce some like draconian rules attacking self-custodial use of cryptocurrency, all these people are going to fight, right? And that's what we saw at the end of the Trump administration when Trump and Mnuchin tried to sneak in that rule. Guess who was like really pissed off? It was like the big exchanges, right?
Right.
I don't personally believe they care about freedom, but that they care about their
business. About money. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are some alignments there, which are interesting, but we will have to see. I'm curious, like, that the NFT, you know, I remember back in like March or April, I think we probably spoke in like May, I think, or June, but
that sounds right.
There was a time when, it appeared that it would just like, it would really like dominate all these different cultures and sports and all these things. And it kind of like didn't, you know what I mean? Like, it's a little weird.
Really,
people are assuring me it'll come next year, but like there was no top shot for football or whatever. Like, I don't really get it.
So there is Top Shot for football, but it's like it's a closed beta right now. It certainly did not happen as fast as people thought it did. And also there's been this real groundswell amongst the progressive movement to be very anti-NFT, which is just sort of interesting.
I saw that, and like, look, it's one of those memes where like the Bitcoiner people are kind of like eating the popcorn in the back, just watching, because like it doesn't really matter. But it's been amazing to watch like the idiocy of the gaming companies going after, saying we're not going to use crypto, or like it. But this is why the mining environmental piece was so important. The reasoning for being anti NFT or being anti crypto, being anti Bitcoin, is going to boil down to the environment. The reason may be something else, but that's going to be the public reason. And the crazy irony is that proof of work, I think, like, actually improves things in that area. Proof of stake doesn't really do anything. I mean, it's just status quo. It just uses the electric grid around you.
Yeah.
I would say that it's disingenuous to say that proof of stake is good for the environment. It's not any better than like just plugging in a computer.
Status quo.
It doesn't change. It's not revolutionary. It doesn't change anything. You can do carbon offsets. Great. Bitcoin miners are going to do the same thing. But the fact is that like we could be living in a world where when you buy like a heater for your home in like 5 years, 10 years, that it comes with like this like Bitcoin mining thing built into it.
Yeah.
And that it helps you balance your load on the grid and could make a much, much more efficient way for us to interact with energy. And I also think that there could be, what would be really cool, in my opinion, would be this, like if you could roll into like Walmart or, you go like a Town Fair Tire or something, like a car store. There's like a group of people that love going to the car store and they're always in there tweaking with their car stuff. I think there's going to be a Bitcoin mining community like that pops up in the next decade, where people are like, you know, sharing their mining tips and like they're all mining all over the place. And like a lot of this country has plentiful solar. I live in a place where we're getting solar installed right now. And, you know, your options are for the excess energy, you can sell it back to the grid. Screw that. I want to mine Bitcoin.
I want to mine Bitcoin.
So, you know, when you're turning sunlight into energy, you know, you're turning energy into money. It's kind of amazing. So I'm excited about all that. And I think that's the area for the no coiners to do their most amount of education on in the coming year. And it won't just be for Bitcoin. Like, again, you're watching the gaming companies go after crypto. You're watching the NFT, the progressives hate on NFTs.
Right.
It's because of the environment stuff. So I think that's an interesting area for us to just keep an eye out on. You should totally do a show on that piece with some people who know more than me about the environment. But
I should. If anyone listening to this, if you have someone who wants to come on and talk about it, you send them my way, because I would love to do that. That would be fascinating.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I appreciate the time. Always fun chatting.
Yeah, thank you very much, man.
It's been a crazy year for Bitcoin. I mean, we should just briefly mention that it was adopted as legal tender in a country.
Yeah.
And it survived an attack from the largest country in the world, basically a punch to the face.
Yeah.
And now we're at mining all-time highs again. So it's been a big year. And I think that there's gonna be a lot more fun and interactivity between the Bitcoin community and the other communities moving forward. But there will always be reminders from the Bitcoin community about why Bitcoin exists and what it's for. So just be prepared to be collegial about it.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. All right, everyone, Alex Gladstein, the Human Rights Foundation. You can find him on Twitter @Gladstein. You guys can check out the Human Rights Foundation if you want to make the world a better place and see how Bitcoin can interact with that. And we'll be back next week.
Hey there. I host a show called Therapy Gecko, where I dress up as a lizard and talk to anonymous strangers from the internet about their lives. They tell me their relationship problems.
I found out that was related to the guy that I was dating.
Their hobbies.
I collect my roommate's toenails and fingernails.
Their secrets.
When we did not have toilet paper, I would use the shower curtain.
And also sometimes kind of serious stuff.
I have anxiety when I talk to people.
I'm also sometimes joined by celebrity guests like Doja Cat, Lil Yachty, Bobby Lee, and Eric Andre. Some of the more interesting calls we've gotten recently include a guy who argued with a demon living on his wall,
a caller drunk at his job at a middle school, and a caller wondering whether or not he should transform into a dog. So if you're sick of your own life and you want to get lost in the life of a stranger, search for Therapy Gecko wherever you get your podcasts.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.